From the Pacifica Network, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. and New York, this is Democracy Now!
Well, we're at a crucial juncture. I don't think a president of the United States has ever done more damage internationally to the stature of the United States. And when you look at the serious intelligence scandal and the fact that the 9/11 Commission is coming out with evidence that demonstrates that failure of the intelligence community and where we are in the Iraq War, we're in a terrible situation right now.
President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney meet with the 9/11 Commission at the White House. They are not under oath, and there will be no recording of the meeting. Meanwhile, the Bush administration tries to block FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds from testifying in a lawsuit filed by relatives and survivors of September 11th. Today, Sybil Edmonds joins us in the studios in Washington, D.C., and we'll speak with Danielle Ellsberg about secrets. U.S. forces attacked the Iraqi city of Fallujah with 500-pound bombs as the Pentagon stands poised to attack the Shiite holy city of Najaf. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C., with Juan Gonzalez in New York.
Hey, Amy, to all of our viewers and listeners around the country and those listening in around the world on the Internet.
Hello, Juan. Yes, the serious situation in Iraq, U.S. forces pounding the Iraqi city of Fallujah overnight, dropping 500-pound bombs on the city. Iraqi hospitals report heavy civilian casualties. Meanwhile, 8 U.S. soldiers have died today in a car bomb explosion south of Baghdad. 2 others died in separate attacks, bringing the total U.S. death toll in Iraq to 737, the Iraqi death toll unknown. Meanwhile, in Fallujah, CNN's reporting Iraqi and U.S. Marine generals have reached a tentative agreement that would hand over control of Fallujah to the new Iraqi army. These reports could not be independently confirmed. A New York Times report is claiming some within the Pentagon now believe many of the attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq have been carried out by members of Saddam Hussein's Secret Service who planned the insurgency before the fall of Baghdad. One governmental official told the New York Times, quote, "They carefully laid plans to occupy the occupiers. They were prepared to try and hijack the country. The goal was to complicate the stabilization mission and democratization." The Times admits it hasn't seen the report that was prepared by the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's based on reports by unnamed governmental officials who claim to have seen it. Meanwhile, a new poll in Iraq has shown that opposition to the U.S. occupation is widespread. 57% of Iraqis want the U.S. to leave Iraq immediately. In Baghdad, the percentage is 75%. It would be interesting to see how these polls are conducted. Here in the United States, a new CBS New York Times poll released Wednesday found President Bush's approval rating at an all-time low. Less than half the country now support the invasion of Iraq. Despite Bush's falling ratings, the poll found he remains in a statistical dead heat with Senator John Kerry for president. And 60 Minutes aired photos last night of U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad. The prison was notorious during Saddam Hussein's era as a torture center. One showed an Iraqi prisoner with electric wires attached to his genitals. Another showed a dog attacking a prisoner. And a third showed prisoners being forced to simulate having sex with each other. Last month, the Army announced it has suspended 17 soldiers over allegations of abuse of prisoners. The military announced today a U.S. general has also now been suspended. One U.S. soldier interviewed by 60 Minutes 2 said he had received little training on treating prisoners and said he had never seen a copy of the Geneva Convention, which governs the treatment of soldiers. The Los Angeles Times has learned a senior Pentagon official is under investigation for altering a multi-million-dollar mobile phone contract proposal in Iraq that would have benefited his friends and colleagues. According to the Times, Deputy Undersecretary for International Security John Shaw is believed to be the first senior Pentagon official investigated for wrongdoing in connection with the massive $18.4 billion package funded by U.S. taxpayers to help rebuild Iraq. He's the Deputy Undersecretary for International Technology Security. Iraqi leaders released another version of the new Iraqi flag on Wednesday after a preliminary version received widespread criticism in Iraq for resembling the Israeli flag. The flag has two blue strips running along the bottom and a crescent above them on a white background. The strips on the new version, much darker shade of blue. In business news, cable giant Comcast has abandoned its plans to buy the Walt Disney Company and ABC. Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy said, quote, "This is a victory for all Americans who are concerned about the dangers of media consolidation. It wasn't just the negative response from investors that helped to undermine the proposed deal. There was a strong expression of opposition from citizen groups, unions, cable subscribers, and many others." The American Civil Liberties Union revealed on Wednesday it had filed a lawsuit 3 weeks ago to challenge aspects of the USA Patriot Act, but the group has been barred from releasing the text of the lawsuit because the government claims it would violate secrecy provisions of the Patriot Act. The ACLU's associate legal director, Ann Beeson, said, quote, "It's remarkable that a gag provision in the Patriot Act kept the public in the dark about the mere fact that a constitutional challenge had been filed in court. President Bush can talk about extending the life of the Patriot Act, but the ACLU is still gagged from discussing details of our challenge to it," she said. The ACLU is challenging a provision of the act that gives the FBI power to request financial records and other documents from businesses without a warrant or judicial approval. The ACLU released a redacted version of the lawsuit on Wednesday. The full lawsuit remains under seal. The Supreme Court has upheld Pennsylvania's new congressional map, even though the redistricting might have been divided to benefit Republicans. And in New York, the city's Parks Department has rejected a permit requested by United for Peace and Justice to stage a large anti-war rally in Central Park during the Republican National Convention. The city claims that the Central Park's Great Lawn is not big enough for the 250,000 protesters. This marks the second time in just over a year New York has rejected a permit for an anti-war event organized by the peace group United for Peace and Justice. Bomb the World by Michael Franti here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington with Juan Gonzalez in New York.
And good day again to all of our viewers and listeners around the country. And Amy, I'm hearing a lot of good things about the tour as you're going around the country.
Well, Juan, it's been really amazing. Last night, big celebration of WPFW, independent media, as the exception to the rulers. It was wonderful to see hundreds of WPFW listeners at the University of District Columbia auditorium. Well, we're going to move right into what's happening today, well, just blocks from here in Washington, D.C. President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney are meeting with the 9/11 Commission today at the White House. Their words will not be recorded for history nor broadcast to the nation. The White House is insisting no recording or transcript be made of the president or vice president's comments, and that only one member of the 10-person panel will be allowed to take notes. Bush and Cheney, who are not testifying under oath, will also be joined by the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and another lawyer from the counsel's office. We're joined in our Washington studio right now by Melvin Goodman. He is a former CIA and State Department analyst, now senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and head of the center's National Security Project. He has just co-written a book called Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk. With these kind of stipulations and restrictions on the White House testimony before the 9/11 Commission, I'm surprised the commissioners are allowed to listen. Mel Goodman.
Well, why did they agree to such an arrangement? That's what I can't understand. They had some leverage on the White House because of the support of the families of the people who were lost on 9/11. And I think they should have used that leverage. I don't think they should have been rolled over so easily. But now that they have them, it's going to be difficult to compare the remarks of one to the other with both in the room at the same time. I hope what they do, however, is not dwell so much on 9/11. I think we know what happened at 9/11, and we know what a terrible failure it was on the part of the CIA and the FBI, and the White House was to a certain extent asleep at the switch as well. But if Bush is going to talk about the need for intelligence reform, I would like to know, does he have any ideas whatsoever about what can be done with the intelligence community? Because here is where the center of gravity is for what went wrong on 9/11, and here is where the center of gravity will be for avoiding another terrorist attack and responding in a way that's more efficient so so many lives are not lost as they were on 9/11. And that's what they have to hear from Bush and Cheney. And I don't think they're going to be hearing those things.
Why did they roll over? And what is the role of Philip Zelikow, who's the director of the 9/11 Commission? We have reported in the past that he is the co-author of a book with Condoleezza Rice. So they clearly are colleagues, are close.
Well, he has ties to the first George Bush administration from 89 to 92. He has a very close working relationship, professional relationship with Condi Rice. He headed a case study project at Harvard and took hundreds of thousands of dollars from the CIA, used CIA documentation, and produced case studies that exonerated the CIA from any charges of politicization of intelligence, particularly with regard to the Soviet Union. And he's generally been an administration voice in all of the matters he's ever dealt with, whether they've been Democratic administrations or Republican administrations. He didn't do a very good job in editing the Kennedy tapes, and archivists around the country have been appalled by the work that Ernest May, who he named a staff member on the commission, and Philip Zelikow did. Having said that, however, the staff studies that we've seen so far, and there have been about a dozen of them, have not been bad. And my problem there is the print media has done a very poor job. Only the New York Times has done one article on the staff studies that point to all of the failures. In fact, if you compare the questioners of the commission, which I have done, to the factual content of the staff studies, you have to wonder if the commissioners are even reading these staff studies, because there's very good information in there about CIA failure and FBI failure and what went wrong at the Pentagon, and these questions aren't being addressed. They spent far more time with Richard Clark's credibility, even though Clark's charges hold up extremely well on the reduced urgency of the Bush administration with regard to terrorism and the war on Iraq as a diversion against the so-called war against terrorism. So you have to wonder who's dotting I's and crossing T's on this commission.
Mel Goodman, you in your book, you talk quite a bit about how the Bush administration has radically changed the U.S. foreign policy in the world, actually since World War II. And you talk about the policy that emerged from World War II, more emphasis on collective security and more emphasis on diplomacy, and that this has been essentially shattered. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think, Juan, there are two fundamental points here. One, what Bush has done is turned upside down 50 years of bipartisan foreign policy on the part of both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations. He's walked away from the international organizations. He's walked away from the United Nations. He's abandoned arms control. He's deploying a national missile defense, which is now funded at over $10 billion a year in the current defense budget, which makes it the most expensive weapon system we have in the defense budget. He's abrogated the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which was the cornerstone to deterrence and the cornerstone to arms control. He's walked away from multilateralism, and he's walked away from deterrence and containment. And remember, when you look at the war against Iraq, it's really symptomatic of a larger way of thinking about the world that is putting the United States at tremendous risk. This was a so-called preemptive war. Well, you can't go to war preemptively unless you have intelligence that gives you that knowledge to go to war. We didn't have such intelligence, so the White House created it. The CIA tailored it. The other point that is important is Iraq is far worse than Vietnam. In the case of Vietnam, I think Johnson and Nixon realized they were in a mess. They didn't know how to get out of it, and it took a very long time. But they compartmented Vietnam, and they tried to protect other aspects of American foreign policy. They established an opening to China. They improved relations with the Soviet Union. They entered into arms control agreements with the Soviet Union, both SALT and ABM. They engaged in incremental and step-by-step arrangements in the Middle East. Even with Syria and Israel, there was one. Two with Egypt and Israel. This administration isn't doing any of that. They're not only not compartmenting Iraq, but they're worsening our relations everywhere around the world, particularly if you look at the press conference between Sharon and Bush that took place in this town only 2 weeks ago.
Mel Goodman, on that issue of the press conference and Sharon and Bush, what about the issue of assassination in Bush League diplomacy, how the neoconservatives were putting the world at risk? You address the issue of Bush lifting the ban on assassination.
Yeah, this is very dangerous. And one thing that took place about a year and a half ago that we gave very little attention to was when the CIA was controlling a Predator armed with a Hellfire missile and blew up a car in the desert in Yemen that supposedly had a driver in it who was from Al-Qaeda, but there was also an American citizen in that car. Four people died in that explosion. You talk about depriving people of due process. This was an American citizen murdered by the CIA. There was never an investigation. There was never any attempt on the part of the Congress to look on this. I think we know now from the Church Commission reports in the mid-1970s how dangerous it is to turn the CIA loose on this kind of political assassination. And what I fear with the combination of preemptive war, preemptive attack, military dominance, a return to low-yield nuclear weapons, which this administration has endorsed, even though the uniformed members of the military don't even want low-yield nuclear weapons. They're dangerous, and you can't fight on a battlefield where you have low-yield nuclear weapons, and unleashing the CIA. This policy is totally out of control.
John Negroponte, he looks like he's about to be confirmed now U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. More importantly, before that, Ambassador to Honduras. We've done a lot on this with people who appealed to him 20 years ago, as Honduras was the staging ground for the illegal Contra war, to deal with the victims in Honduras of a CIA-trained battalion 316. What do you know about this?
Well, the very simple thing about John Negroponte that has to be known is he was part of the cover-up of the human rights disasters and the murders and the civil rights abuses that took place in Honduras during the time that he was ambassador. Now, part of this was part of the Contra war, but the cover-up is something that never should have been tolerated. So if you look at around the administration and you see Elliot Abrams in the White House, who's supposed to be in control of Middle East policy, even though he has no knowledge whatsoever of the Middle East, if he hadn't been pardoned, he would have been in jail. Negroponte was involved in a cover-up. John Poindexter, who's no longer in the administration, also had to be pardoned, or he would have been in jail. So the abuses of this administration and the politicization of every department and agency of this government is on another scale. And that's why I strongly believe that no president has reduced America's international stature the way this president has.
Mel Goodman, to return to Iraq for a second, we're hearing reports now that Paul Bremer and the coalition provisional authority leaders have begun to meet with a lot of the former Ba'ath party leaders in an effort to find some group within the country that can achieve stability before the June 30th deadline. Any thoughts about that, as now even former generals in the Iraqi army and other major leaders are being talked to about coming back into some sort of power?
The problem with that is it's probably too late. We're scrambling once again. It was Bremer who came in, who replaced General Gardner, who made the decision to let the Iraqi military go, let the Iraq police go, let Iraqi law enforcement people go, don't deal with any Baathists. Well, these were all the people who were responsible for a certain amount of order in this country, in the country of Iraq. To try to patch this together now, just as Bremer is leaving and Negroponte is coming in to man this huge American embassy that will have more than 1,000 American officials in it, but still not real authority because the military is still running the country of Iraq, the American military. So it's not going to be sovereignty or limited sovereignty for the Iraqis, and there's not going to be any real control on the part of the ambassador.
We're going to take on that issue of a little bit of sovereignty with Phyllis Bennis next, who will join us in our Washington studio. Mel Goodman, I want to thank you for being with us, longtime CIA analyst, now co-author of the book Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
America, how are you? I'm just calling to check in. 'Cause lately you've not been yourself. I think you've forgotten something. You've forgotten yourself. You've forgotten who you are. You become the mean eyed bully, standing up behind the bar, shoving dollars in your pockets with bootleggers in the back. You got the cops out in the front room, making sure the decks are stacked. And you think that you're opening, but this ain't no poker game. 'Cause you're not looking out the front door to see the ones who curse your name. You've stolen and you've plundered in the name of liberty. Sold your soul to the highest bidder, and still you claim that you are free. So I'm calling to remind you there's still a chance for change. Take a deep look inside, see the beauty that remains.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 220 radio and television stations, Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network. In fact, we'll be broadcasting next week for 4 days out of Free Speech TV's studios in Boulder, Colorado. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United Nations Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, 2 weeks ago proposed a possible way for the U.S. to hand over power in Iraq after June 30th. Under the proposal, the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council would be dissolved and replaced by a transitional government appointed by the U.N. until national elections scheduled for January 2005. The Bush administration has backed the plan, which would allow the U.S. to remain in charge of military and security matters. Brahimi met with the U.N. Security Council Tuesday and said the Iraqi caretaker government could be named by the end of May, a month ahead of the so-called handover of sovereignty from the United States. Yesterday, Lakhdar Brahimi called for an end to military hostilities in Iraq, affirming there must be a voice for the city of Fallujah in the new Iraqi government. He also said the deteriorating security situation would not be allowed to postpone the transfer of sovereignty. The proposed plan is running into heavy opposition from the U.S.-appointed interim governing council, most of whom would be excluded under Brahimi's rules. Iraqi National Congress leader Ahmed Chalabi said this week on Fox News, quote, "Mr. Brahimi is an Algerian with an Arab nationalist agenda. He is already a controversial figure in Iraq. He is not a unifying figure. He is supposed to be a unifying figure so he can choose a government that will be effective." NBC has a news story out this evening which reports members of Chalabi's INC in Iraq are currently being investigated by the Iraqi police for abduction, robbery, quote, stealing 11 Iraqi government vehicles and assaulting police by firing on them during a search. Phyllis Bennis joins us now, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome, Phyllis.
Good to be with you, Amy. Good to have you in Washington.
It's great to be here. What is happening right now with Lakhdar Brahimi and the campaign, it looks like, against him? Juan Gonzalez, by the way, also in New York.
Juan, good to be with you. There's a huge campaign, as you say, against Lakhdar Brahimi. It emerged from the ambassador of Israel to the United Nations. The New York Times columnist William Safire have weighed in. And aside from these rather racist remarks about, well, he's an Arab, so of course you must expect this sort of thing, there have been some very specific attacks on Brahimi that he has targeted the Israeli occupation as a major problem in his work in the region as a whole. And in doing so, many people, including the Israeli ambassador, Safire, and others, have come out and said, well, this proves that the United Nations is not neutral, which, of course, is true. The United Nations has never been neutral on the question of illegal occupation. And as any UN official should, Brahimi has come out and condemned that occupation and said that it's making the solution of the Iraqi occupation much worse. Now, what Brahimi is proposing has several components, and some are very important. He has called, as you said, for the dissolution of the illegitimate governing council. That's a major step forward from the earlier positions, the demand from the U.S. that the governing council or an expanded version of it remain in power. So that's a significant advance. The real problem is the issue of sovereignty. Brahimi's proposal, and Brahimi is ultimately a very pragmatic man, a very pragmatic diplomat. His position ultimately does not challenge this idea of being a little bit sovereign, which is essentially like being a little bit pregnant. A country is either sovereign or it's not sovereign. And if there are 150,000 foreign troops occupying its territory, I would say that's not sovereignty.
And Phyllis, in terms of, being from Puerto Rico, having been born there, I know this issue of what is sovereignty and what is autonomy when you have U.S. troops on your soil. But indeed, I'd like to ask you, some recent polls from Iraq, even though it's hard for me to understand how polls in Iraq in a period with so much battling and warfare going on could be valid, are indicating that many Iraqis seem to support the position of Brahimi in terms of possibly having this transitional phase. What do you make of that?
Well, I assume that many in Iraq are reacting in very much the same way that we're discussing it today, that they believe that the U.S. is simply not going to withdraw its troops, and therefore the question is what level of sovereignty, what level of legitimacy could be picked out in small amounts absent real sovereignty. I think people in Iraq are being very pragmatic and saying what's realistic here. If we're serious about legitimacy and we're serious about sovereignty, in my view, that requires the end of the U.S. occupation, not a change in its name, not saying that on June 30th we will transfer authority when there is no authority to be transferred and no one to transfer it to, but say there must be a real end to the U.S. occupation. And then, and only then, after the U.S. occupation, could we look at the possibility of a United Nations team led by the United Nations, but with the participation of the Arab League, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the other regional organizations, to provide the Iraqis with real support for reclaiming their sovereignty. In a situation where those international forces are not trying to steal their resources, claim their oil as their own, and occupy the country, I think that the level of violence would be severely diminished. We would not see a situation where we're told now the UN could not answer this level of violence. Well, of course not, nor should they be expected to. But there would not be this level of violence because the violence is directed at the occupying army. Absent the occupying army, I think that it's inevitable that the level of violence would be significantly reduced.
Although the UN was blown up.
That's right. The UN was blown up and attacked terribly. 22 staff members, including Sergio de Mello, killed last August 19th, almost a year ago now. But that was in the context of the UN being seen by Iraqis and others around the world as doing the work of the U.S. occupation. The key is to separate those and say that the UN is not going to send in significant, not only troops or police, but significant staff to run elections, to help with economic development, all of those things, until the end of U.S. occupation.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Phyllis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C. She's also author of the book Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C., where our Pacifica station WPFW is located, and in New York, right down the road from Pacifica station WBAI. We're going to break for a minute, and then we'll be joined by a whistleblower, Sibel Edmonds. We'll also be speaking with Daniel Ellsberg about secrets.
You become the mean eyed bully, standing up behind the bar, shoving dollars in your pockets, with bootleggers in the back. You got the cops out in the front room, making sure the decks are stacked. And you think that you are winning, but this ain't no poker game, 'cause you're not looking out the front door to see the ones who curse your name. 'Cause you've stolen and you've plundered in the name of liberty, sold your soul to the highest bidder, and still you claim that you are free. So I'm calling to remind you there's still a chance for change. Take a deep look inside, see the beauty that remains. America, how are you? I'm just calling to check in, 'cause lately you've not been yourself.
America, how are you? Erica Laquette here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Washington, Juan Gonzalez in New York. The Bush administration is trying to block FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds from testifying in a lawsuit that's been filed by relatives and survivors of September 11th. U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton said on Monday he would hear classified evidence next month from the government, which is expected to cite laws regarding state secrets in order to gag the Turkish-American translator. The administration claims her evidence would, quote, cause serious damage to the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States. Sibel Edmonds was hired after September 11th by the FBI to translate pre-9/11 intelligence gathered by the agency. She has publicly said on Democracy Now! And other media outlets that the U.S. had considerable evidence al-Qaeda was planning to strike the United States using airplanes as weapons. She was subsequently subpoenaed by the law firm Motley Rice, which represents hundreds of families who are taking civil action against a number of banks and two members of the Bush-connected Saudi royal family for allegedly aiding al-Qaeda. The Bush administration has requested the hearing be closed to the public and the press. On Monday, journalists and activists appeared at the court to object. Judge Walton yielded, and the hearing was subsequently open to scrutiny. However, Edmonds' testimony has been postponed till June, and the question of whether her deposition will be allowed remains unresolved until further review. How many lawyers walked into the court, Sibel Edmonds, on Monday to take you on, to decide whether or not, or to argue against you being able to speak publicly?
Well, the government sent about 8-9 attorneys there, and it was a scene. It was a scene.
Now, what exactly are they saying? They're saying they want to impose a gag order on you now, but you already have a gag order on you.
Correct. The attorneys for Motley Rice were arguing that they were only going to ask questions on information that had already been public, you know, on your show, on the newspapers, and also information given by the FBI to the Senate Judiciary Committees during unclassified meetings with them. However, now the FBI is saying even that information is top secret and national security, and it cannot be used even though the information is already public.
Wait a second. Are they saying that They are asking for a further gag order that would prevent you from repeating what you have already said here and in other places?
In a way, that's what they're saying. They're saying any information that has already been public still is considered classified, and it should not have been public, and the FBI should not have had this unclassified meeting with the Senate discussing it. So regardless, that information cannot be used.
Let's backtrack. What have you said? What do you think is the most important people to understand in this country that you learned as a FBI translator with top security clearance when you went back to the pre-911 wiretap conversations that you translated?
I have provided testimonies to the Senate and to the 9/11 Commission and to a certain extent unclassified version of it to the press, talking about translations that were either intentionally blocked or mistranslated that were given to the agents in various fields that contained specific information about activities and the support network of Al-Qaeda. And that information has been public, and the fact that this information was blocked intentionally has been already confirmed by the Senate Judiciary Committee.
And when you say, Sybil, that the evidence, that the tapes and the translations were either intentionally blocked or inadvertently mistranslated, are you saying that these were substantive errors that gave a different meaning to those translations?
Yes. And not only that, the reasons they were blocked, as I said, partially was incompetence and partially was intentional. Also, we had instances where what Attorney General Ashcroft is citing in this state secret privilege, certain investigations were not pursued due to diplomatic relations.
Sybil, in your testimony before the 9/11 Commission, Senator Grassley, a conservative Republican senator, said he finds you highly credible. It seems that what you have now said publicly, that the U.S. knew before 9/11 airplanes could be used as weapons, that information was coming out before 9/11, contradicted what Condoleezza Rice had been saying before she was put under oath. It seems your testimony has changed her testimony. You said that what she originally said before she was under oath and just speaking on the networks, etc., was an outrageous lie. What was it that you were saying?
Well, about a week before this hearing when Condoleezza Rice testified in front of the commission, she made the statement that we did not have any specific information. And at that time, I said that statement was an outrageous lie because we includes the FBI, her advisors, and therefore the statement was an outrageous lie. Well, she corrected herself during the commission hearing by saying that she made a mistake and she should have said, I personally did not have any specific information, rather than using we, which again left this whole question of we unanswered, and the commission did not pursue. Well, who does that leave behind? If she was not given this information, who is the rest of this we?
We're talking to Sybil Edmonds. She was an FBI translator with top security clearance after September 11th, looking at the pre-September 11th wiretap conversations. Can you tell us who was talking, who you were translating?
I cannot. I am not allowed to talk about any specifics of the targets of investigations or even what type of documents we were translating.
So why have you come forward?
I have come forward. I have been out there for past 2 years and 2 months. I came forward about a month before I was terminated, going to the Senate and presenting them with this information because some of these inactions and some of these issues were continued after September 11, months after September 11. The Bureau allowed certain targets, certain people leave the country months after 9/11.
Like who?
Well, I cannot talk about who, but people who should have been criminally prosecuted here, the real people who should be detained here, and real people who really need to be investigated. And yet we hear about people being detained for INS violations. Yet, on the other hand, hypocritically, we are allowing certain people leave the country.
Where are these people from?
I cannot talk about that.
Well, we're going to talk about what it means for you to take a stand like this, to come forward now, the 9/11 survivors and relatives of those lost wanting you to testify in their lawsuit, the U.S. government not wanting you to. We're going to talk also with Daniel Ellsberg, who is on the line with us right now, another famous whistleblower in U.S. history. In October 69, he began smuggling out of his office and Xeroxing 7,000-page top-secret study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, known as the Pentagon Papers. He did so with the intent of revealing these secrets to Congress and the American public, and in so doing, he set in motion actions that would eventually topple the Nixon presidency and end the Vietnam War. He is author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, once described by Henry Kissinger as the world's most dangerous man. Can you respond to what Sybil Edmonds is now doing as another whistleblower, she with the FBI?
Well,
Dan?
I'm very happy to be on the program with Sybil Edmonds. She's certainly one of my heroes at this point, and I'm glad to have heard of her effort. I admire what she's doing very much, and I think she's serving the country very well.
We're going to break for 1 minute, Dan Ellsberg, for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll come back to a conversation with Dan Ellsberg and Sybil Edmonds, two whistleblowers here in the United States. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Juan Gonzalez is in New York. I head off to Boston today as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour. Tonight at Cambridge Forum at 7 o'clock, we'll be there with Noam Chomsky, seeing listeners and viewers throughout the Boston area on public access TV and community radio. And then we head off to Santa Fe and Albuquerque on Saturday, to Houston on Sunday with KPFT listeners, and then to Denver and Boulder through the next week, as well as Salt Lake City, Seattle, Portland, and Eugene. So looking forward to seeing folks there. You can go to our website at democracynow.org/book to see the tour and find out where you can come out and celebrate your community media, your Exception to the Rulers. We are talking about state secrets. We are talking with whistleblowers. Sybil Edmonds in our Washington studio, an FBI translator with top security clearance, or I should say an ex-FBI translator, who looked back before September 11th to translate and look at the pre-911 wiretap conversations. We're also joined by Daniel Ellsberg, one of the world's most famous whistleblowers who released the Pentagon Papers. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask Sybil Edmonds first and then Daniel Ellsberg as well. We journalists depend for a lot of the information we get and distribute to the public on whistleblowers, but little attention is paid to what happens to the whistleblower after they go public. I'd like to ask Sybil Edmonds, what has been your experience once you went public, what impact on your personal life has occurred, and as well with Daniel Ellsberg, although his is perhaps a little better known?
Well, it has been an uphill battle for 2 years and 2 months, and as you can see, I'm counting the days. And there are times that it becomes so difficult when you feel like, okay, that's basically it. There is not much left that I can do, because after you pursue all three branches of the government and all formal official channels available to you that, you know, that you can pursue, and as you see, nothing happens and everything gets to be covered up, you get to this point that you think, well, maybe there is nothing to be done. But then I guess I stop and remind myself that, well, it is not supposed to be this way. I mean, we supposedly have this transparency, although it's disappearing, and therefore we are supposed to be having this accountability, which also is disappearing, and we, again, are supposed to be having this system of checks and balances, which I'm still looking to find, and reminding that gives me the fuel to just go on and say, you know, if you do it and if you insist upon it, maybe you can make a difference and maybe you can change, because the direction we are in right now, it just looks, seems very alarming.
Dan Ellsberg.
Yes, I want to repeat my admiration for what Sybil Edmonds has done for the last 2 years and what she's doing right now. From my own experience and that of other people that I've dealt with, I want to assure her that more can be done. She hasn't really tested the system all the way. She's sort of in the position that I was in 69 and 70, where I'd given 7,000 pages of top-secret documents to the Senate and was waiting for them to hold hearings and to bring it out, as I was several times promised, twice basically promised, would happen by Senator Fulbright. But he backed off in each case because of the bureaucratic punishment that he expected to get from the administration. And it just didn't come out. It wasn't enough to give it to Congress. In the end, it took giving it to the press directly and to the public through the press to get Congress to really take account of it and to get that information out. And even that didn't change the policy right away, but it set in motion some events which did have powerful effects in the end. So what I'm saying here is that, in a way, Sybil Edmonds is right now in the position that Katherine Gunn was before she decided to put out her document. She, too, is a translator, she's fired, a translator for the national security bureaucracy. She worked for the equivalent of our national security agency in England, and she did, in fact, put out a document that was highly classified and was put on trial for it. The trial... she faced a couple of years in prison, and the trial actually was terminated when the government decided they didn't want to argue the legality of the war, which she would have brought up in court. What I'm saying is that so long as the public has not heard from the people you've told so far, which I take it include the 9/11 Commission and perhaps Congress, when they've kept silence and at the same time, as I understand it, have judged that, in their opinion, this does not harm national security for it to be out there. They're under a gag order from the administration. It remains for someone else, Sybil herself or someone else who knows this information on the staffs or who has had access to it, to let the public know and to do that at risk. To say that the risk is real, and it really is real, is not to say that it precludes the public getting that information. One can take the risk, and it takes courage, but as a matter of fact, it's very obvious to me that I'm talking to someone here who does have a lot of courage, Sybil Edmonds, already, like yourself, Amy. And Sybil, as the source, you as a journalist, have both shown great, great courage so far, and that courage can go to the point of accepting the risk of trial.
And Daniel Ellsberg, when you took that step, when you made your information public to the New York Times and Washington Post, what was the impact on your life for those people who either were not alive then or not old enough to know?
The information was received with the public as confirming things that a lot of more less left-wing people had believed or had suspected for a long time. There had been indications of it, but no confirmation. So for everyone, at the least, it was a confirmation. For many people, it was an amazing revelation that president after president had consciously lied about every aspect of the war, as is certainly the case right now. The impact of that on public opinion about the war was very great, and yet the public had already turned against the war in large. By that time, it just they went more against the war in a way. And since the president wasn't paying any attention to public opinion, it didn't actually affect his policy right away. The war went on. If you'd asked me a year after the Pentagon Papers came out, after bombing had increased in many ways, I was asked that, and I did say, I had to say, it had had no effect. It was worth putting out, it was educational, but it had had no effect on the war. Actually, that was premature, because the president was so worried that I would put out, President Nixon, that I would put out more information, documents that would bear on his policy, Nixon's policy, that he took a number of acts to shut me up that were then criminal. And when those were found out, it did lead, in part, to his resignation and to an end to the war. By the way, those acts are no longer criminal, most of them, under the Patriot Act, so our country has changed a good deal since then, but some of them are still criminal. Trying to beat me up on the steps of the Capitol is still a crime.
Well, Sibel Edmonds, what do you think of what Daniel Ellsberg has just said? The idea that the wrath of the state comes down before, in the case of Catherine Gunn and Britain exposing documents that the U.S. and Britain were spying on members of the U.N. Security Council, they said that they would put her away for a very long time. It was a very frightening time, but in the end, they dropped the case. In the case, the same with Daniel Ellsberg. Do you feel the wrath of the state right now upon you, and in what ways? And do you think you might be ready to release documents, the kinds of things you might have told the 9/11 Commission about secretly or privately?
Well, first, I want to thank Dan, and also I would like to say that I'm honored to be on the same show with him, because I have read all about him, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for Dan. No, I do agree, and as I said, this has been going on for 2 years and 2 months, and I went through the appropriate steps, believing that they were appropriate to do and they were the means to achieve having the truth to get out. And I had gone to the Inspector General's office, and they were supposed to release this report in fall 2002, and now they're not releasing it a year and a half after that deadline has been over. I have gone to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I have gone to the OPR. And now, finally, this is the 9/11, which is basically my last hope. And if through this investigation they don't make this public, then I have to step forward and just put an end to it. And I think the time is approaching.
Are you afraid?
There are times that I am afraid, but then again, I have to remind myself that this is my civic duty, and this is for the country, because what they are doing by pushing this stuff under this blanket of secrecy, what they are hiding is against the public's welfare and interest. And reminding that to myself just helps me to a certain degree overcome that fear.
Sibel Edmonds, I want to thank you for being with us, FBI whistleblower, 9/11 whistleblower. Daniel Ellsberg revealed secrets that helped to end the Vietnam War, the 7,000-page top-secret study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, known as the Pentagon Papers. This is Democracy Now! As we move now to our last subject, took place right here in Washington, D.C. yesterday at the Supreme Court. It heard argument in two cases to determine whether the White House can detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without ever having to press charges or allowing the citizen a chance to appeal their detainment in court. The cases involved two U.S. citizens who've been held as enemy combatants, Jose Padilla and Yasser Assam Hamdi. Padilla, U.S.-born citizen in Brooklyn, was detained at Chicago's O'Hare Airport nearly 2 years ago for allegedly plotting to set off a dirty bomb. Hamdi, an American-born Saudi, who was turned over to U.S. forces by the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan in 2001. Both men have spent 2 years in custody on a naval brig in South Carolina. They've never been charged with a crime. They've been barred from seeing any evidence against them. They both have no access to a lawyer until recently, when their attorneys were allowed to meet with them under supervision. supervision from Navy officials. The justices indicated the hearing yesterday a central concern of the court is whether President Bush acted with sufficient authorization from Congress to declare citizens captured at home or abroad as enemy combatants and then hold them indefinitely without criminal charge for interrogation. The justices yesterday seemed divided, with no clear majority discernible from their questions and remarks. This is an excerpt of Deputy Solicitor General Paul Clement's opening argument in the case of Yasser Hamdi before the Supreme Court yesterday.
Petitioners contend that the government categorically lacks the authority to hold Hamdi as an enemy combatant. But it has been well established and long established that the government has the authority to hold both unlawful enemy combatants and lawful prisoners of war captured on the battlefield in order to prevent them from returning to the battle. Over 10,000 United States troops remain on the field of battle in Afghanistan. No principle of law or logic requires the United States to release an individual from detention so that he can rejoin the battle against the United States.
That was an excerpt of Deputy Solicitor General Paul Clement's opening argument before the Supreme Court. During the proceedings, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor asked Yasser Hamdi's lawyer, Frank Dunham, if he felt Congress had given the president to take whatever action needed after 9/11 to fight the war on terror.
The authorization for use of military force does not have the word detention anywhere in it. It talks about use of force, mm-hmm. and it is the equivalent, in our view, of a declaration of war.
But look, it does say in this authorization, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks.
If that is interpreted to mean that he can impose indefinite executive detention on anybody that he thinks is necessary in order to fulfill that command, we could have people locked up all over the country tomorrow without any due process, without any opportunity to be heard.
That was Frank Dunham, Yasser Hamdi's lawyer, arguing his case before Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. We're joined by Nat Hentoff. His latest book, The War on the Bill of Rights and the Gathering Resistance, your assessment of the Supreme Court case yesterday and the oral arguments that were presented.
Well, again, it looks as if Kennedy and O'Connor are going to be the deciding votes. And both are, according to the questions, are themselves conflicted. You showed one example of O'Connor leaning toward the government. But on another point, she asked, have we ever had a situation like this where presumably this warlike status could last for 25 years, 50 years, which means they could be held until they die? The key line in there was she said warlike status. Does she mean, and I think this is the case, that there has been no formal declaration of war? That resolution, which is now at the part of the core of this case, does not, as Frank Dunham say a word about detaining citizens and the like. The other thing is, and it's only been marginally mentioned, if at all, to show you the brazen trickery of the government in this case, Clement said, well, they've had lawyers. Well, they had lawyers very suddenly, and just before the court, just after the court agreed to hear the case, the government lawyers and Bush from the beginning said the courts had no jurisdiction. This is entirely up to the commander-in-chief. So finally, to make their case look better to the court, they let Frank Dunham and Donna Newman and Patel, Patilla's lawyers, get in. This is what happened. Dunham gets in there. In the cell with his client, Hamdi, is a naval officer. Dunham looks up at the ceiling, sees a red light. They're videotaping it. And outside, there's a monitoring thing. The essence of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel for American citizens is lawyer-client confidentiality.
And Nat Dunham Hentoff,
pardon me?
On that note, we're going to have to say goodbye, but we're going to pick this up and continue the conversation with you on these critical Supreme Court cases. Nat Hentoff, his book is called The War on the Bill of Rights. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Juan Gonzalez in New York. We head to Boston, Cambridge Forum, Simmons College, and Mary Baker Eder Library. Thanks for joining us.